This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff, and we are now at episode number 35. And as always, thanks for listening. Thanks for the support of the show. And thanks for all your messages and emails. That makes it all worthwhile. And I really appreciate hearing from some of the listeners really all over the world. So that's always exciting. So thank you for that. Very excited about today's show. Just happy that it happened. I got to talk to Scott Miller, Dr. Scott Miller. I discovered an article he had written. I mean, I've followed his work for a while. I discovered an article he had written recently for the Psychotherapy Networker titled "How Psychotherapy Lost Its Magic and Art of Healing and the Art of Healing in an Age of Science," an article he wrote with Mark Hubbell. And this article, just kind of one of those articles you read and it just kind of stays with you and you start telling other people about it. And it's just one of those articles that I keep talking about that has really stayed with me and just kind of has me thinking a lot and also really captured some of my own experiences, some of my own ways of thinking about the work that we do. And you should absolutely read it. It'll be in the show notes. Just look for the link in the show notes. But I'm really excited that we have a chance to talk to Scott about that article, about some other things too, but also that article on today's show. But before we get there, I just wanted to do an ask. I wanted to ask a favor for those of you that are listening. If you would, it'd be much appreciated if you would go over to iTunes and subscribe to the show and go to iTunes and rate and review the show. It would really help us get in front of people and spread the word. So please, if you have a few minutes, go do that for us. It'd be much appreciated. And also, we have the new YouTube channel, the new Radical Therapist YouTube channel. Please go take a look for us on YouTube. We've got several videos up now, and you can subscribe to the show. You can watch the videos, like the videos, and also share them with your friends, and that would be very much appreciated. So now let's not waste any more time, and let's get right to the show and meet with Scott Miller. So before we do that, let me tell you a little bit about Scott. Scott Miller, PhD, is the founder of the International Center for Clinical Excellence, an international consortium of clinicians, researchers, and educators dedicating to promoting excellence in behavioral health services. Dr. Miller conducts workshops and training in the United States and abroad, helping hundreds of agencies and organizations, both public and private, to achieve superior results. He is one of a handful of invited faculty whose work, thinking, and research is featured at the prestigious Evolution of Psychotherapy Conference. His humorous and engaging presentation style and command of the research literature consistently inspires practitioners, administrators, and policymakers to make effective changes in service delivery. Scott is the author of numerous articles and books, too many to talk about here, but definitely go to his website, scottdmiller.com, and you can get access to all of that stuff. So take a look at that. But let's not waste any more time. Let's go meet Scott. Okay. Hi, Scott. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much.
And glad to have you here, and I appreciate you taking the time. And I am very familiar with your work. I've attended your workshops and find the stuff, and I follow you on social media, et cetera, because you are always active and posting a lot of interesting stuff. So this is just for the audience too. If you're not following Scott on Facebook or on his website, you should be doing that because he's always throwing up interesting stuff that we should be knowing about. But what really captured my interest, I mean, I've wanted to talk to you for a while, but you also, the thing that kind of drove it is you wrote this article, which we're going to get to in a second, with Mark Hubbell, titled "The Art of Healing in the Age of Science," which I just thought was a fascinating article, and I get the sense you got a lot of response about it from it too, as well.
We did, and we were really surprised by the number of reads the article got. There's so much out there and available that's really high quality. In the issue of the Networker where that article was published, there were really top-notch articles written by cutting-edge researchers and practitioners. And yet that particular article really got a lot of attention.
Yeah, that was great. But before we get to that article, I got a lot of questions about that article. But before we get to that article, you are arguably the leading researcher in what makes for effective therapy. And I guess I was wondering if you could take us and the listeners back a little bit and tell us how you got started out on this path.
Well, I think there's both a personal and a professional interest. I have never been a very confident practitioner. From my earliest days in grad school, other students, fellow students, seemed to understand how this worked and what they should do with their clients much more quickly and much more aptly than I, at least listening to them speak. And so I've been driven by a desire, a strong desire, to figure out what I was supposed to do in the room. And that was all the way from what I said to people to how I held my arms or the way I looked at people in the room. In addition, I think I've just been very lucky to have some remarkable mentors and teachers throughout my career who have spent their lives doing research or trying to digest what the research said. So all the way back to my grad school days when Lynn Johnson, who was a local psychologist who invited me to sit behind his mirror, didn't charge me anything, and we would sit afterwards and talk about his cases. Through Lynn, I met during that time many of the leading practitioners of the day who were swinging by and saying hello or conducting workshops in the area. Through Mike Lambert, who I did some research work for, my stats professor, Bruce Wampold, who I met as a graduate student. And those relationships continue to today. And they had a shared passion for understanding what the literature said and how it could be applied in clinical practice, which matched up with my personal passion to figure out how the heck do you really do this?
I guess in you did find, and I'm going to kind of summarize your work a little bit, but you propose there's three keys for therapists to improve their work. And the first one is knowing your baseline. The second one, deliberate feedback. And the third one, deliberate practice. And I guess for, can you say more about that?
Well, I think that the key here is that in my really personal journey to try to figure out how to be more effective, I pursued the path that most clinicians even today pursue, which is you go to grad school, you get a lot of training in a lot of things. After grad school, you attend continuing education workshops where most of the time is spent either on describing the potential problems that people come with and the methods that can be used. I myself moved from California after my postdoc to Milwaukee to work with Insu Berg and Steve DeShazer. I was still feeling very insecure as a therapist, and the work that they were doing was very explicit. Here is what you say. Here's what you do with clients when certain kinds of conditions present. Now, as perhaps old-fashioned as that idea seems now, or perhaps passé as that idea seems now, at the time, we were mostly doing psychodynamic therapy, and there was very little explicit attention paid to what you said and did. Now we have treatment manuals, and Insu Berg and Steve DeShazer were really on the cutting edge of saying, here's how you work. I learned that model. We were claiming that the work could help clients in a much more timely and effective, efficient way. Researchers came and we discovered that what we had been telling people simply didn't hold up. We were effective. The approach that we developed was effective, but it wasn't any more effective than anything else. What's more, it wasn't any briefer than anything else. And in fact, the brevity of therapy was oftentimes a problem. The modal number of sessions that people came to treatment was one. It had always been one, dating back to the 1940s. In other words, we suffered a huge dropout rate from people who initially contacted us for help. And a significant number of those people, in fact, said they weren't helped when they were followed up. This caused a real disagreement on the team, and the team split. We went searching for how do you become more effective? If, in fact, our models didn't leave us more effective, which is, again, the primary way that most clinicians approach improving their work, attending those workshops and getting trained in specific models, then what would lead us to be effective? for nearly a decade, we looked at common factors, the common core elements that all models share, thinking that if it's not the specific ingredients within an approach that maybe make a difference, maybe if we really fleshed out the qualities that all good approaches shared would help us. Turns out that didn't make much of a difference either. Eventually, I think out of desperation, we decided, well, if we don't know how to become more effective, if all of these things seem to have an equal chance of working, maybe what we need to do is simply measure our results. As luck would have it, I'd been working with Mike Lambert, who was pioneering using outcome measures in routine clinical practice, and Lynn Johnson, who developed his own alliance tool, a measure designed to assess the quality of the interaction between the client and the therapist. We began measuring, and we soon were back to our fundamental problem, and here's why. By measuring, we began to discover that certain therapists were reliably more effective than others. That begged the question, how did they do it? And here again, we struggled for some time until we stumbled across the work of K. Anders Ericsson, a Swedish psychologist who had been spending his life studying expertise and expert performance, but not in the field of psychotherapy. Instead, he was helping athletes, bankers, computer programmers, surgeons improve their performance by something he called deliberate practice. Deliberate practice is simply a focused attempt aimed at addressing an individual practitioner's specific errors or shortcomings. In order to do that, in order to engage in deliberate practice, you first have to measure your baseline performance. That you need to do in order to discover, well, where are my particular errors? This, by the way, is why there's no evidence that attending continuing education workshops improves your outcome. Mm-hmm. How could it? It's too general. It's too vague. It doesn't help you identify where you, in particular, go wrong. It just makes sense. You're not going to get any better at playing the piano by attending a general piano workshop. You need someone who can watch your performance and figure out where you need help individually. Establish your baseline performance. Then you need to get some feedback. Here's what you do well. Here's what you could do to improve. And then finally, you need to repeat that over and over again over lengthy periods of time. That's called deliberate practice, and those are really the three steps. In 2016, we published really the first article looking at the impact of deliberate practice on the performance of therapists. And what did we find? We found that performance improved. Now, what's critical about this particular study is that it is the first in history to show that an activity is associated with improvements in effectiveness at the individual clinician level. None of the other things we are mandated to do and do out of our desire to get better actually make any appreciable difference at the individual effectiveness level over time.
Yeah, which begs the question, I think, in some ways, that, like, what do we do about grad school? Because they are being taught everything that you're kind of finding counter to what equals good practice.
Yeah, well, that's where it needs to start. And I'm feeling hopeful because the topic of routine outcome measurement and deliberate practice is truly the hot topic right now in the Society for Psychotherapy Research, for example. Mm. We were, I think, intoxicated by our infatuation with medicine and the hope that we would be able to establish a psychological formulary. Oh, you have anxiety, we will do CBT. Oh, you have OCD, we're going to do exposure therapy. That idea is huge. Oh, you have trauma, we're going to do EMDR. The idea that somehow we could, like pharmacists, identify the problem and apply the right treatment is really intoxicating. In fact, so intoxicating that that's where I ended up right after graduate school. Because again, I was feeling worried about what do you say to clients, and steeped in medicine from Marcus Welby, MD, all the way to the current shows on TV about physicians, that's the mentality. Right. You have a problem, take a pill, cut it out with surgery and expertise. So I understand that particular temptation. However, nowadays, I think we're moving a bit beyond that, and I'm seeing signs in grad schools that the measures are being picked up, not just our measures, but other groups' measures, and a process be put in place where clinicians can very early in their training start to get the very important feedback that their professors have to offer. I think the field has just been hamstrung by this paradigm that is applied to psychotherapy when it really doesn't work. It really doesn't fit psychotherapy. And that I mean the medical paradigm.
Right. So if you were talking to, I get a lot of emails from students that are in grad school and stuff.
Yeah.
If you were talking to them or speaking to them, what would you suggest some easy things they can do to start headed in that direction?
Well, the first thing I would say to students in grad school is get done and get out.
Yeah, right.
Because much of graduate school is about fulfilling the requirements for their particular professional discipline. I think that training is a lifelong and career-long process.
Right.
The second thing I would talk about is download some of the scales and begin using them in your practicum, or take them to your practicum supervisor and ask if they can be used. There are a host of resources now that you can tap that weren't available even 5 years ago. The ICCE, the International Center for Clinical Excellence website, is a place where you can go. It's basically a social network where clinicians are trying to apply the ideas of deliberate practice to their work. There you can get some support. Next thing I would say is find a good coach. Find somebody whose work you admire. Pick up the phone, send a text or an email to these folks and ask if you can get consultation on an ongoing basis. People are always surprised that, number one, I answer my own phone, and number two, when students are emailing saying, is there something that you can do to help me in my effort? My response is generally positive. I just had a student from Stanford reach out to me 2 weeks ago. She had been working with Greenberg in their Alliance Lab, and she said she was very interested in deliberate practice. We have an intensive that comes every August, and I said to her, why don't you come to our intensive? She said, oh, I'm a student. I said, you can come on me. You're interested. I just get so few requests like that. I think people are really caught up in just managing their day-to-day lives. Mm. But oftentimes when you ask, the door opens. Once you get a good coach, for example, for me, that was Lynn Johnson. Lynn is somebody who I've had a relationship now for over 30 years. Wow. I still email him. We still talk. We still send research back and forth. And these are types of encounters that I value deeply. And as I say, continue to today.
That's great. Okay, so why don't we move to your article now? And once again, that article is titled The Art of Healing in the Age of Science, that you wrote with Mark Hubbell. And I found it fascinating. But you start the article by sharing a story of a woman who lost her daughter, didn't have great experiences with therapists, and found a medium or a psychic that was very helpful. And then you make the argument that this is happening more and more. And can you say more about that?
Well, I think psychotherapy is the modern form of healing practices that have taken place for millennia amongst humans. Mm-hmm. Our particular way of construing healing fits within the current culture, which is medicalized and secularized. But most people who could benefit from seeing one of us don't go. Now, generally, the field attributes this to ignorance, a lack of information, or client resistance. But many of the people that are so labeled are actually accessing help from other healers in the community. Psychics, aunts and uncles, mediums, other form of naturalistic ministers, and such. And my question was, well, why? Why do they go there rather than seeing one of us? After all, we are the so-called legitimate healers in this modern age.
Right.
And our sense is that it's because psychotherapy has a very limited narrative that it accepts as acceptable healing. So your problem when you see a therapist is typically located in your feelings, in your thoughts, in your behavior, or in your brain chemistry. If it falls outside of that, then we don't recognize it. And that just doesn't fit the way most people think about their lives and the healing process. It's not that those four areas aren't legitimate. They're absolutely legitimate. But I'll also say that psychotherapy and modern psychotherapy certainly didn't discover these things. Magicians dating back to the 1800s and earlier were talking about changing your thinking and changing your feelings. And they had a whole host of other ideas about how to engage people in a process that helped the person they were meeting with become more functional in their lives.
And yeah, you use the numbers that 33% fewer people are seeing psychotherapists than 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And that it's getting harder to make a living in this field. And I think this is a thing that's on the forefront of a lot of people's minds that I'm interfacing with. Can you say more about that?
Well, I think if your practice is full, then it's easy to think, gosh, the field is doing really well. But if you step back and look at the field as a whole, it's not doing well. As you cite in the data that we cite in the paper, fewer people are seeking out psychotherapy. Most people who have a mental or emotional or spiritual issue go to their family physician and they're given a drug. If you look at federal government data, the large percentage of people are now taking a medication rather than talking with a therapist, even though if you ask them, would you rather talk to somebody about your problem than take a pill, a plurality of people say they'd rather talk. So the question is, why? Why would they choose to take a pill? Now, we might say things like, well, it's easier or insurance pays for it. I would say the narrative of medicine has been sold very strongly. And yet, even there, the vast majority of people who could benefit from a medication or from talking with us still don't go. They instead talk to other people. And that's what the article was really about. What is it that psychics, mediums, spiritual leaders, or advisors know that we don't know or that we exclude in our work, that if we tapped into that, we might attract more people and help more people?
Yeah, which is a great segue, because you, with some trepidation that you spoke about in the article, sought out the mentalist community and kind of, I guess, embedded yourself a little bit or immersed yourself a little bit with some concern about what your professional colleagues might think about that. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Well, you know, we're not the first group that did this. In fact, William James, many of whom consider the so-called father of modern psychology, was also investigating this area. There's a fabulous book, a fabulous summer read that called Ghost Hunters that looks at his work with investigating, rather, mediums and psychics of his day. And interestingly enough, William James was making much the same argument that we were making, which is maybe we should look at this group and see what we could learn from them and stop excluding them from the healing process, instead embracing how they're working and perhaps embracing their work in general. At the time, medicine was asserting its control over the healing of mental and emotional problems, and James really paid a price for that. And so we were also a bit worried about what price might we pay if we started talking openly about this work. We take no position on the reality of these effects, so I have no idea why the medium was able to do what she did, or, as we describe in the article, our first encounter with a mentalist whose comments about me in his first interaction made the hair on my head stand on end. They were uncannily accurate about me, despite the fact that he'd never met me, and the information that he told me about myself wasn't available in any social media. So again, I thought, why don't we investigate this group of people? Secondly, I'm a scientist. I'm steeped in scientific methods. And so that was the other piece. How would we be viewed as serious scientists if we said, wow, let's take a look at these mediums and psychics? Again, we take no position on the reality of this. I don't think that's what's important. What I think is important is the outcome of their work. Why is it that that industry grew during the recession? Think about this. That industry grew during the recession while psychotherapy was shrinking as a whole, while people were deciding to take drugs rather than talk to us, while they were deciding to go to the gym rather than talk to us, all of which are good for the person, but not necessarily good for the profession.
Yeah, and so one of the mediums you worked with, you share in the article, quoted Shakespeare, there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy. And the medium continued that psychotherapy may have abandoned the magic long ago, but people never have at the deepest level they believe. Can you say more about this role of magic with a K in healing and how psychotherapy has lost it?
Well, I think when we think nowadays, it's very curious. When we think of magic, what we think of is trickery. Magic is indeed, in the current mindset, not really magic. So when you see a magic trick, everybody thinks, well, how was it done? And no one believes that it's real or true. So that's labeled superstitious thinking. If you believe that there are magical events in life, then you're engaging in superstition. So here was the logical leap that we took. There is, despite what therapists believe, there is no evidence that the methods we use uniquely contribute to the outcomes we measure. So whether it's moving fingers back and forth in front of people's eyes, it's tapping on them, or you're confronting their dysfunctional thoughts. When researchers like ourselves do what are called dismantling studies, that is, we take apart the models piece by piece and we leave out the ingredients that the founders of those models consider essential, the models work equally well. So let me say that again. You take out the ingredient, the very thing that the founders or believers in our approach think is essential to its effectiveness, and the model works equally well. So now, if therapists continue to believe that my effectiveness was really a result of me using method A, B, or C, that is magical thinking. It is essentially no different than using charms, crystals, potions, etc. Now, that may seem discouraging to some. To me, after reading this literature and working with the challenge of how do we get more people to come in to see us, it was absolutely freeing. Instead of limiting myself to thoughts, feelings, emotions, and brain chemistry, I could use almost anything at my disposal to create an impact that would help improve the client's functioning.
Can you this say is some what examples?
Say again? No, I was going to say, this is what magicians have been doing for, again, millennia.
And can you say like some examples of what that has allowed you to access outside of thoughts, feelings, and these kinds of things? Maybe some of the things.
Well, I think there's a great deal going on in the field right now that is similar to magical processes. What for me is important here is tapping into what appears to be a quality shared by most members of our species, and that is the super sense. And the super sense was defined by a social psychologist named Bruce Hood, who points out that the majority of us see and believe in forces outside of our awareness and external to us that influence how we think, behave, act, feel, etc. Some of us see that in the form of telepathy. Others see that in the form of parents' impacts on child development. But in every aspect, or in both situations, the belief is that there are these unseen forces. In fact, Bruce Hood argues that this is part of the social glue that keeps us all together, these unseen connections. It forms the basis of social connectivity. And so if we can tap into people's super sense, and then you have the ability to engage them and facilitate a healing process. But the particular methods are much less interesting to me because they are unending. As I said, it could be crystals, it could be tapping, it could be some other engagement in a ceremony or ritual that leads some folks to stay engaged in the process of changing their lives for the better.
Yeah, that's great. Okay.
Prayer is one of those. Prayer is one of those things that humans have been doing again for millennia. But you don't see many therapists engaging in prayer. Now, I wouldn't pray with a client who didn't ask me to, but why wouldn't one consider it if the client found prayer very helpful, if they believed that in their heart, if they found that a way to connect with something bigger than themselves that facilitated an improvement in their functioning?
Okay. And in the article, you identified, I think this is helpful, you identified three distinct processes for reuniting psychotherapy with its true magical roots. And the three are exploration, entering, and embodiment. And I was hoping maybe you could walk us through these three things.
So if the idea is that we are embracing a larger view of the healing process beyond the mechanical, materialistic view of medicine, which I'm not naysaying. I think it's, we have to be clear and careful here. What we're saying is it needs to be expanded beyond those narrow narratives that are currently acceptable in the healing process. Then there are sort of three ways that practitioners can approach this. The one that most are familiar with is the exploration of magical worldviews. And I say that term, magical worldviews, with respect rather than with derision, as I might have spoken about it in the past.
Sure,
They're just superstitious. To me, exploration is what most therapists do. Somebody comes in and says, well, I believe X, some non-materialistic view that they have of the world or their functioning or their problem. And therapists, I think, do a really good job of saying, well, tell me more about that. What leads you to that? How does it impact you? How can we change that? But it's a little bit like being on a tour bus exploration. You don't really get out and into the culture. You sort of observe it from a distance. There's not much commitment there, and it goes only so far. We know that when clients consider, for example, their religious and spiritual views a something that's important to discuss in therapy, but still, despite it being part of what are considered an ethical mandate for therapists, being aware of the cultural diversity of our clients, most still don't even ask about clients' religious or spiritual views. Instead, it's what's your problem and let's apply some particular method to it to treat it. So simply opening up the conversation, most clients want therapists to do that. Most therapists still don't do it. The second way that you can begin to embrace a more magical worldview is to get beyond exploration and instead enter. And the example we give is of a client whose therapist meets with a very religious person who's also quite depressed. And the therapist's basic approach is a CBT approach. And what that therapist does is enter the client's reality by changing the terms of the approach that he uses to better fit the client's worldview. So the therapist, who's quite familiar with this client's conservative Christian background, talks about the sin of pride, that this man wouldn't accept help from others, despite the fact that the help was being offered, and that kept him isolated and depressed. So by talking about the sin of pride, the therapist gently confronted this man's thinking that kept him stuck, or so reasoned the therapist. Turns out the care that he provided was quite effective. The client became engaged and became more functional. That is not likely to get people to see us differently enough to get them in the door. So as you told in the beginning of the podcast, we tell a story of a person whose daughter had died after a lengthy illness, and she was severely disabled. And this particular person wanted to be assured that her daughter was okay. Mm. Now, from a purely secular, materialistic point of view, that idea is bunk, really.
Right, right.
The key for the therapist would be to help this client accept and grieve appropriately, which is what the first two therapists that she met with did.
Hmm.
But the client's expressed wish was never fulfilled, which was, is my daughter okay? By accident, this person is at a shop getting her hair done and hears about this medium who talks to the dead. One of the other patrons suggests, why don't you go talk to her? She's really quite a friendly person. Mm-hmm. The client goes and to see her, and as soon as she sees this woman, she begins to relate that she thinks she's there because of her daughter, who was lost recently to death.
Mm.
The client then expresses her wish. I really want to know, is my daughter okay? The medium begins to talk about and describe two elderly people that the woman identifies as grandparents. And they're there taking care of her daughter. The impact, as you get from the story, is overwhelming. And in my workshops, I show a video interview with this particular person that we interviewed, and you can just see it in her face, the relief she got. Now, what's surprising to me is that the skeptic community says that that's actually causing people problems. I would say that the failure to not just explore and not just enter, but embody that worldview prevented her from healing. And within a few short visits, this woman is moving on, right, as is her family, her other kids.
Right. Yeah, it has me thinking a lot of things. I guess, and you share about getting your cards read, and you shared earlier about having kind of a profound experience. And I have to admit that I was skeptical too. And then a good friend of mine, we were somewhere on a trip, and he talked me into seeing somebody because he had seen psychics kind of regularly. And I just had a similar experience. It was pretty profound, this person. What was your takeaway? I mean, what was your experience? I mean, being a scientist, how do you make sense of this? Or is there any need to really make sense of it rather than just kind of go into the exploration, entering embodiment, and just kind of going that route? What do you think?
I think, first off, that psychics and mediums are a lot like therapists. Hmm. Not all are created equal.
Yeah.
And so you may not have a profound experience the first time or the second. My own experience with the person that we reached out to was really quite profound. And I continue to be amazed. In fact, I've got this person coming over for another interview just next week, next Tuesday, to my office. I continue to be impressed. But this is a leading figure among mediums and psychics. Hmm. Whenever I travel around, if I have an extra few minutes and there happens to be a psychic or a medium nearby, I'll go in and have my cards read or the crystals thrown or whatever. And I watch carefully what they say, because I would like to be able to emulate the feeling I have frequently gotten when having met one of these, which is I feel seen and the advice I get makes sense to me and is actionable and doable.
Yeah, great point. Yeah. Yeah. So,
and I've had similar experiences in therapy. I've seen therapists personally myself that I saw once and I didn't go back. And I could tell you in most instances why. I didn't feel connected. I felt judged. I whatever. Right. And I've had other relationships with therapists, in particular one, that have been profoundly life-changing and helpful. My interest is not in what's going on, but how can I emulate this behavior? Because what I'm interested in being is healing. I don't care if I'm a therapist.
That's great. Okay, so just kind of in closing, I guess maybe I'll ask you, so how are you feeling about the future of psychotherapy? What are you thinking?
The future of the field, you know, I am less and less interested in therapy as an institution. I find it very limiting.
Interesting.
Now, that doesn't mean that I don't want to help therapists. That's my entire career.
Right.
But talking about healing in the context of the narrow narratives and the way we have construed it is increasingly over the last 40 years is just not interesting to me. There are so many different avenues, and I see so much incredible work being done. So let me give you a couple of examples. Great. Ian Caldwell, who is a really talented agency manager in the UK, and I have an interview with him on my blog probably 2 or 3 months ago, is doing, and his agency, I believe, is called Starfish, is doing some really interesting stuff, really designed and aimed at engaging people in a healing process. We live increasingly in an atomized society. People, and psychotherapy as it's currently constituted, contributes to that. You go in a little room and you talk to one individual, when really what I think heals people is relationships and connection, social engagement. So in England, for example, the government is supporting groups held in coffee shops. People can come in and have a free cup of coffee and talk with people. How earth-shattering.
Yeah, right.
We used to do that. Nowadays, you don't even sit in the coffee shop. Instead, you stand in a line and you run out and get back in your car and look at social media.
Right.
So I'm exaggerating some. But I think there are so many innovative things that we could be doing that would contribute to healing and connection among people beyond psychotherapy.
That's great. Okay. Just could you, I know you have some stuff coming up. Would you like to share maybe with our audience how to find you, what's going on, stuff you got coming? Yeah.
So like you said in the beginning, Chris, I'm on Facebook at Scott Miller, and every day or every other day, I'm posting research findings and articles. I am a scientist, first and foremost. I'm interested in science. I don't see science as something to believe in, however. Science to me is a method. I find the current debate about science, that people believe in science or not, I find this rather silly. Science to me is a method to figure out if my beliefs are productive beliefs. So the other place you can find me is on my personal website, which is at scottdmiller.com. And you can sign up for my newsletter and my announcements about my blog posts. And that's usually the best way to reach me. Every summer and every spring, we offer a series of intensive courses aimed at both deliberate practice, and I'm sure we'll be adding a course on magic here and shortly.
Yes, sign me up. Sign me up, yeah. Okay, Scott, I thank you very much for taking the time. This has been wonderful, and I'm really interested to see what you do in the future with magic, because we know we need it, so thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, that's our show. And thank you, as always, for listening. And if you want to reach out to me, I would appreciate it. You can contact me via theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. You can request stickers. I'd be happy to send those out to you. If I have any t-shirts left, I will send those to you, too. You just need to ask and let me know what your size is. And we'd be happy to do that. If you
Want to know or haven't seen the Radical Therapist t-shirts, just go to the Instagram site at The Radical Therapist and check us out and go follow us on Instagram. You can also follow me on Twitter at The Rad Therapist. That's Twitter. And of course, we have a website at theradicaltherapist.com. We love interfacing with you via social media, so please find us and follow us, and we'll follow you back. So, so as always, you know, thanks for listening to the show. My name is Chris Hoff. This has been The Radical Therapist.